Don't forget to come up and vote. There should be like 100 tick marks by the end of the day. Two people voted.
Excellent. Shall I go ahead and get started?
Yes, please.
Okay, all right. So, just really quickly, some background on me. My training's in urban planning. But about 15 years ago, I spent a couple years as a spatial analyst with NOAA in their coastal remote sensing program. In terms of research, I am doing some environmental planning research. I talked a little bit about that this morning, but it has been focused primarily on exposure to heat in urban areas, social vulnerability. I'm also interested in the role of technology in planning and urban management more generally, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So, without getting too far into the weeds, I'm going to be drawing upon an ongoing project that I've got going on right now that looks specifically at open data resources and civic technology. I'll tell you exactly what I mean by civic technology in just a bit. Civic technology is a relatively new term. It's still evolving. Different people have different understandings of that. I just want to be clear. So the map that I'm showing you here is giving you a sense of one component of this research project. So it involves collecting and analyzing data from open data repositories around the country, comparing open data policies that are basically driving the governance of these resources. And then this portion of the research consists of, I've conducted 26 telephone interviews with various actors within the broader civic technology ecosystems in these 9 cities. And I'm showing this to you because I'm going to be drawing on some of these insights in my presentation today. And I should also say that while I'm going to be approaching this through the lens of this particular project, I think there are some perhaps useful synergies between my goal of better activating open data resources and the goals of the conference. Basically, how can we package or frame or do sustainability science in a more impactful way. So that's where we're going. So, as an urban planner who's interested in technology, smart cities are inescapable, right? Smart cities, I think, are a very useful definition that I found is that smart cities, they're a mode of development that really centers technology. So when we talk about or when we think about smart cities, we often imagine sensors that are detecting and collecting reams and reams of data. We're swimming in data, literally, all the time. Maybe even we think about the networks or the mechanisms for transmitting and sharing that data. But I think, unfortunately, we still don't perhaps pay enough attention to people. Where are the people in this broader conversation about smart cities, about how technologies, data are deployed, used to inform decision-making, policy? How are they and how should they be leveraged to improve quality of life, address issues like equity, global climate change, etc.? And so one of the fundamental questions for this part of my research agenda is how can we better democratize these advancements? How can we leverage them to realize some of the purported benefits, right? How can we make, for example, government more transparent, responsive, and accountable, as one example of this? And so, really quickly, a bit of semantics. Citizen engagement versus citizen participation. Citizen engagement and citizen participation are related terms, they're not synonymous. Citizen engagement tends to be more formal, tends to be driven and initiated by government, whereas citizen participation tends to be, at least ideally, is citizen-initiated, less formal. But the point is, or the reason why I'm including this, this graphic here, is that ideally citizen engagement will evolve over time and sort of stabilize as citizen participation. So more meaningful dialogue, interaction, dare I say co-production between the public or citizens or residents and government, other actors that are relevant within this system. All right, so as urban planners, we think a lot about participation. Why is participation important? It's important because participation is understood, has been long understood as a foundation or cornerstone of democracy. From a more practical perspective, my colleague Lou Hopkins argues that from a planning perspective, public participation is important because you get better ideas if you involve more brains. Involving key actors at the outset makes it more likely that your work products are going to be used, because impact, having our work and our insights and our knowledge that we're generating, having those be used, I think is something that we are all very much interested in and doing a better job of. Involving a variety of stakeholders reduces the likelihood of conflict and resistance later, from, again, a more practical perspective. And then perhaps fundamentally, participation creates citizens. Participation, there's something in the act or the practice of participation that is empowering, and that it gives a sense of ownership, right? It helps to shape what it is that we're doing collectively as a society. So with that bit of introduction, maybe you've seen this visualization, this data visualization, maybe you've seen others like it, but basically this is based on 311 calls that were made to the city of New York in, during the 1 week period. And these are basically presented over time, over the span of a day. And there are some interesting patterns that emerge here in terms of when people are calling about streetlights versus noise complaints versus rodents down here. But the point, the reason that I'm showing you this graphic at this juncture in the presentation is, again, to reiterate this distinction between engagement and more meaningful forms of participation, right? So 311 calls, the data, are ubiquitous. Cities are collecting this. Pretty much any city that you go to is collecting this information. But we can ask ourselves whether this kind of interaction is really participation. Sure, it's engagement, sure, but is it bi-directional? Is it full-fledged, meaningful participation in terms of informing decision-making, policy, etc.? So I'm going to shift gears here and answer the sort of leading question. What is it that I mean when I use the term civic technology? And it's pretty simple. Civic technologies are tools and processes that we use, that we develop to improve public life. So they are focused on not technologies or a specific product or software or platform. They're focused on the improvement of public life writ large. And so this might include, or this might involve, more effective government, connecting participants in, say, the sharing economy, supporting localized social networking, social activism, public participation, etc. And so what are some examples of tools that might fall within this, again, somewhat still evolving and large notion of civic technology? Web applications. Web applications that are used to make data more intelligible and accessible are one example. Data journalism. We're increasingly seeing accessible visualizations from publications like The Economist to The New York Times to more local news outlets. So data journalism, providing context for these kinds of data resources, I think is important. And then social media. Social media as a means of connecting with others, and sometimes for a cause. So someone over here had actually written organizing as, I think, a solution to one of the issues that was identified. And so thinking about how technologies like social media can be leveraged in different ways for advocacy purposes is something that I'm really interested in. But it's not just tools, it's also processes. It's how we structure processes, the kinds of processes that we implement. So from conventional public meetings, which we've probably all had the pleasure of experiencing, to something like the student-led geodesign process that I was part of last semester in Biola, Illinois. That is, by its very nature, it involves co-production with, it's iterative, and co-production with the public, with local stakeholders. Or from more competitive, infrequent hackathons to more collaborative, recurring civic hacking meetups like Chai Hackathon. And you can see me with much more hair sitting there in the back with some students from several years ago up in Chicago as examples of processes or maybe even institutions that I think are relevant to this overall idea or phenomenon of civic technology. And so as we just heard, the tenet of build with and not for is central to civic technology. So thinking about how we can improve quality of life, how can we strengthen our communities, how can we address pressing problems, but to do that in a collaborative way that is not top-down and that aspires to co-production, build with and not for. I'll let you just read through some of these other recommended aspects of this as well. And then I think what else is important when we're talking about how technologies are and data are used, deployed, is we need a healthy sense of humility, right? I think perhaps the initial question should be, can technology, can data be useful? Because that's, the answer is not always yes. Not all problems have a technical solution. And I think being embracing that as a possible outcome is important. Okay, so that hopefully gives you at least a general sense of what I mean when I use the term civic technology. So, yes?
Is it the same thing as public interest technology? Is that another word for that?
I'm not familiar with that term.
Oh, okay.
So perhaps. That's a term that I haven't heard. It sounds similar, but so I'm going to quickly give you a sense of the kinds of actors that I've encountered in my research on civic technology ecosystems around the country. So, I'm studying open data, I'm studying civic hacking, and that civic hacking that has emerged around open data. And so, one example is from Louisville. So, you have building up of geospatial data resources in Louisville as one example of the kinds of activities that are involved in civic hacking and civic technology more generally. You also have the development of web applications like this one, Affordable Housing Austin. So I had the opportunity to interview the developer of this app, who was a Code for America fellow who came and worked with Open Austin, but also worked with the local planning department here in to try and leverage some of the data resources to provide some different insights into affordable housing where it is, where it's needed, and to also help connect households who are in need of affordable housing with resources for finding that. So civic hacking, nonprofits, civic hackers are part of broader ecosystem. Nonprofits are involved in this. Also from Louisville, you have the American Printing House for the Blind. They've leveraged those open data, those OpenStreetMap resources to develop an app for visually impaired persons where they can use their cell phones. And I'm not quite sure how this part works, but there's they can point their cell phones at objects in the environment and get some sort of, almost like a sonar feedback to help them navigate. And that's combined with wayfinding services that are based on OpenStreetMap. So there's also partnerships. Perhaps you've heard about the Waze partnership with cities, several cities around the country have entered into these agreements with Waze to get access to their mobility data, to use that for planning purposes, et cetera. And then another example of data partnerships would be DataUSA, which is a partnership of MIT, Deloitte, and a new nonprofit. And basically, what you have here is you have existing data, census data, but this group is adding value to that, making it more accessible, helping to activate it in a different way, which I thought was really interesting and worth mentioning. And it gets to this earlier discussion about how can we do better outreach? How can we do a better job of telling stories about the work that we're doing as a way of supplementing the way that we are currently distributing our findings, our insights. City government obviously is a player here. So city services, recycling, snow plows, emergency management. But again, oftentimes with a neighborhood focus, which helps to personalize it a bit. And then corporations. Corporations are obviously involved in open data as well. This is an Israeli company that is using AI, artificial intelligence, to analyze those 311 calls that all cities have. Right? What they're doing is they're selling a platform that uses AI to basically take the pulse of what the public is interested in. And cities around the country have signed on for this. City of Austin's not signed on to this. Houston uses it. There's several other smaller cities in Texas that are using this as well. And then you have corporations like January Advisors out of Houston that are essentially consultants, that a lot of their business is taking data and making it more accessible, activating it for the purposes of local governments or nonprofits. Really quickly, I wanted to mention something that was new to me, B corporations. I'd never heard of this. So what's a B corporation? A B corporation is a legal entity. And it's these entities are required to consider the impact of their decisions, right, on workers, customers, suppliers, community, and environment. So if we're talking about how do we do a better job of addressing social equity, quality of life, this is interesting to know about, right? Because they have a legal responsibility to show how they're doing these things. And it's really interesting because they're sort of between a corporation and a nonprofit. They're allowed to make a profit, but again, they have this mandate, they have this legal obligation to also think about the public good. And so some examples, locally here in Austin, you have Aunt Bertha, which is a B corporation, and basically what they focus on is connecting people with social services. Which, again, a novel use of data to address local needs, but also to improve service delivery and hopefully to improve quality of life, address social equity. In Philadelphia, Azavia is a company that focuses more on geospatial technology and research. But again, a B corporation, and so they're also thinking very much about civic and social impact as part of this. Why is open data important? I'm going to speed up just a little bit. Looks like I've been talking for almost 18 minutes. So Michael Batty says, with the deployment of smart city technologies, it's really important to think about the data. All the sensors, all the sort of passive data collection that's going on. If the data are open, then you at least make it possible for a wider array of stakeholders to engage, to become involved, to ground truth, to critique, to fact check some of the narratives that are being used, to justify or to assail policy proposals, right? And so bringing this back to urban planning, there's a lot of conceptual scaffolding that fits here, I think, in terms of collaborative planning, working with communities as opposed to coming in from more of a top-down approach. Urban planning has wrestled with that decades ago. But also thinking about information as a centerpiece, as a raw material for building shared meaning, social relationships, and cultivating network power. If you want to talk about influencing policy, this is provides another mechanism, another avenue for doing that. And there's also, just for GIS literature, web-enabled participation, citizen science literature that's also relevant here. And so in terms of open data, there are a lot of purported benefits of open data. If we open up our data, we're going to have more transparency, we're going to have greater accountability, we're going to have more democratic governance. So there's a lot of claims that have been made. And so this research project that I'm doing now is trying to, among other things, test some of those claims. And so one of the motivating questions for me is, how can we better activate these open data so that those purported benefits can be more widely realized? And so there's a paper that's coming out. And the basic argument is that it takes an ecosystem. And civic hackers, organizations like Code for America, Open Austin here, for example, as well as universities, nonprofit organizations, play a really critical role in activating these open data resources, right? Basically, taking raw data that might just sit on the server somewhere or might not really see the light of day, activating it through mapping, through web applications, through other means, where it's possible for residents, for media, earlier I mentioned data journalism, to interact with that information. And so it's possible that you can then open up another avenue for influencing. Earlier today we had some discussion about lobbying, right? Why not deputize or empower residents, media, for advocacy purposes or lobbying? If we're serious about influencing policy and decision making. And so I was asked to talk a little bit about what currently works, what needs work, and a way forward. So I'm going to do that really quickly. So what currently works? What have I come across? And thinking about parallels between this and the focus of the conference. So in terms of civic hackers, this idea of civic hackers as advocates, there's increasing interest in technology, particularly among young people, which I think focusing on thinking about how we can better engage or interact with youth is worth talking more about. And then here's a quote from one of the interviews. Oftentimes, civic technology helps fill the gap when there's a need but not a business case. So consultants, your IBMs of the world, might not be interested in all the issues that local governments, communities are facing. And so what I've seen in my interviews and the research that I've done is that oftentimes, and certainly in cases where you have a more mature civic technology ecosystem, these are the kinds of projects that are coming out of those ecosystems. And mature civic hacking communities can also not just take on an advocacy role, but can help inform the governance of these broader open data initiatives. So the demand side, in terms of, it's not just, well, we'll take the low-hanging fruit, we'll put our 311 calls out, but what would actually be useful, interesting, meaningful for people who are going to use it, or what would be relevant to ongoing discussions in the community about priorities. So, and cities around the country are adopting open data policies, embracing data as one way to be more transparent, more responsive, which I think is encouraging. And I'm going to skip this. You can get a sense for the growth of open data. Another thing that is working well right now, philanthropic organizations are funding effective and reproducible programs within this arena. So the Knight Foundation has invested a lot of money in civic technology and addressing some of the challenges that I'm going to talk about in just a second. And then you also have What Works Cities as one example of Bloomberg Philanthropies is behind this, but basically they provide technical support and expertise, but they also are very much interested in identifying and distributing best practices. So peer-to-peer sharing of what works across cities around the country, which I think is really gets to the question of scalability and impact. So what needs work? Co-production requires basic literacy if you're talking about data, technology, sustainability science, right? So there's a literacy gap when it comes to data and technology. It's a reality. One of the more interesting pilots that I came across in this research was up in Buffalo, where, to my knowledge, this is the first program like this in the country, where they actually held 4 sessions. And they are taking residents who are interested, and they're training them on how to interact with and make use of these open data resources as a way of building capacity and starting to bridge this gap. And then another issue that is perhaps not surprising, the technology sector has a diversity problem. Diversity, equity, inclusion. And I'll let you read the quote here from participant number 19. But the reality is that civic technology, just like the broader technology sector, is still dominated by younger white males, which raises questions of representation, of equity, when we start talking about the deployment of technologies or implementation of policies in this arena. And so thinking about ways to address this, this issue, I think is really important as well. So building technical literacy, but also thinking about diversity, inclusion, equity. And so strategies for moving forward. So the good news is, bringing this back to the specific focus of the conference, public trust in science is increasing, or in scientists, I should say. Certainly over the short term, relative to 2016. This is a study from the Pew Research Center that came out a couple weeks ago in early August. And you can compare scientists to the news media and elected officials. So arguably, that is encouraging. But again, it invites the question of the disconnect. If the public is increasingly, has growing trust in scientists, then why are we talking about the frustration of translating science and the insights that come out of research into action? And so in terms of getting there, I would argue that strategies for better activating sustainable urban systems science parallel this question that I've been talking about of how do we activate open data resources. You have to cultivate a demand side. You need to have someone who's going to use the research that you're doing, the insights that you're generating, right? And so part of that, I think, is building technical capacity of the public, but also thinking about institutions that are going to have state power. So getting back to one of the examples, a one-off hackathon that's focused on one particular issue is not the same as having a dedicated community of practice that meets regularly and is more fluid in terms of its focus and that builds capacity and can serve a role like an advocate and draw upon data as a source of influence in that advocacy role. Those are very different things. Strengthening partnerships within the university, beyond the university, I think, is self-evident. And then better outreach and storytelling. We have to do a better job of getting what it is that we are doing, what it is that we're finding, out to different audiences, right? And I think the technology can help with that. But ultimately, this question of how do you cultivate a demand side is really, I think, critical. It used to be that, well, if you go back to the 70s, social learning, you had this idea of policy as, you know, a transactional relationship. Academics create knowledge or solutions that are then pitched to decision makers. And they either accept those solutions or suggestions or they don't. What I'm saying is that you can create, there's a different way. So rather than trying to necessarily appeal directly to elected officials or policymakers, perhaps engaging with the public, with, say, civic hacking communities, with nonprofit organizations, and giving them the tools to be conversant. And that might provide, again, another mechanism for influencing policy and decision making without having to go through the conventional channel of this bilateral transfer between researchers, decision makers. Maybe there's a different way we can enlist the help of the public, of these communities of practice that I was talking about, and nonprofit organizations, and perhaps that can help to move the needle a bit. And I'm at 30 minutes, so I'm going to stop.
Thank you very much, Bev. Also, that getting there slide, I think that provides some good nuggets for us to think about. So we have time for a few questions.
Do you have a sense of what it costs to keep open data accessible? I mean, I'm assuming it's more for a city than it would be for maybe a small municipality. Do you have a ballpark?
I'm not sure how much it would cost, but my sense is that it wouldn't be as wide a range as you expect. The vast majority of open data portals are run with an off-the-shelf platform. Socratic, which is subscription-based, or CCAN, which is open source. And one of the things that, so the interviews that I mentioned, I talked to civic hackers, government officials, nonprofits, there's a fourth category that's slipping my mind now. But what the government folks repeatedly told me was that this, once you go down this road of opening up your data, there's a lot of costs that are involved. So making sure the data are fresh, responding to requests. I had someone from Philadelphia refer to it as technical debt. So anyone in the world can call her and ask her about a data set, and she has to respond to that. And so I think that there are non-monetary costs associated with that. Mm-hmm. But my sense is that the actual costs of setting up and maintaining a portal are not going to vary as much as we might think if you're in, say, Philadelphia versus in a much smaller place.
So is it more of just how much data do you want to reduce and prepare for public consumption? Do you think where the biggest sink for money is going to be? And just manpower and grinding through it and having it ready?
Well, I think that staff time, because someone's going to have to go around and figure out which data to open up. Someone's going to have to prep it, because you can't. Some data are sensitive, talking about criminal justice information or health information. So there's some staff time that's involved in that, in addition to the actual infrastructure that would probably include something like Socrata or CCAN, some servers.
You started your talk with reference to a whole bunch of, wide swath of goals that engagement and participation, for that matter, seek to achieve. But almost all of what you talked about subsequently had nothing to do with the effects that it has on individuals, right? So this comes out of a lot of different strains of thought about democratic theory. How participation and engagement changes individuals, how it affects your ability to govern yourself. And yet we know from an awful lot of research that the more engaged you are with civic technology, the more alienating it is. We know that for individuals. People are less likely to want to interact with other people when they use the technology. So how do you square that? I think it's easy to make the argument that when I use civic technologies, I'm probably going to get government to be more responsive to me. All right, it's probably going to do more of what I want the government to do for me.
Okay, so as I understand your question, what you're considering civic technology is broader than what I'm talking about when I'm talking about civic technology. So, I mean, there's a lot of literature that talks about the alienating effect of, say, YouTube or Facebook or social media, etc. What I'm talking about is, again, tools and processes. So it's not just social media. Social media can be leveraged. But what makes it civic technology is that it's focused on addressing issues, that it's focused on improving quality of life, improving services.
For one person, for me. When I use the civic technology, I want to improve things for me. I don't really care about you.
I would disagree with that.
Well, where's your empirical evidence on that?
Well, we don't have time. Well, I have a different presentation that I could do that talks more about specific examples. So civic technology includes things like in Houston with criminal justice reform and leveraging data resources, opening up these data resources as a way of helping people who have served their sentences to have their criminal records expunged. So I guess I have a little bit of an issue with the characterization of civic technology as something that is individualized, because the point that I was hoping to convey was that civic technology, when it's deployed as a community of practice, when it's, sure, you can have individuals who are engaged in civic hacking, but I think that these initiatives are more sustainable when it's more than just some person sitting in their office or sitting in their basement working on this. I think it's important that, there are a lot of things that I couldn't say. So civic technology is built with and not for, but it's also one of the fundamental objectives is to get technologists, non-technologists in the same room and working together, right? This idea of co-production, I think, is central to my understanding and the understanding that I've seen of what civic technology is. I agree that there's been a lot of discussion about the alienating role of cell phones or social media, but I would argue, and I hope that what came across in the presentation was that civic technology is more outward-looking and it's more focused on addressing issues that are facing the broader community using data and technology.
Yeah, so I think that both presentations, what they are suggesting is that, again, it's not the technology itself that's going to be the solution, but really thinking of the technology in this broader social context, and that when we design that technology, that we consider that social context as well, and how is it going to be used, and what are some unintended consequences of the technology as well, and all of these kinds of things. But I think that we're both advocating for, it's broader than just the technology. It's really how it is used to enhance, as you were saying, quality of life, and just human action, right, and interaction.
So tools and processes.
Right, exactly.
Good. Any other questions? All right, great. Yep. So one more.
So a lot of the open data that Sunrise Signals is actually open but facilitated to third-party providers. And so we are in a lot of conversations with the city of Portland right now as the one of the earliest ordinances around open data and citizen data. And there's some real issues that cities have to more or less buy a black box and are not sure if they're really able to protect the privacy of their citizens. And so I see a lot of the potential, but there's a lot of issues, particularly because it is quite pricey to do this in-house. Most cities don't have the capability, so they have to get external vendors to implement those open repositories. And there currently is a tendency to put way less in those open platforms than exists, because cities are really freaked out about giving away too much involuntarily.
Great, thanks. So now to, I think, bridge between the coffee break and our next interactive activity.